Listen to us online, on your phone, download a podcast, or on your tablet. Radio Gorgeous, there for you.
Today, I have the great pleasure of welcoming Irish writer Liz Nugent to Radio Gorgeous. Welcome, Liz.
Thank you. It's lovely to be here. It's lovely to be in London.
Yes. And we are sitting in a lovely sort of solarium in London.
Yes. In a Georgian house, looking out into a gorgeous back garden on a duskening afternoon.
Exactly. In the gloaming.
Yes.
Exactly. And that, of course, is Radio Gorgeous headquarters. And what could be better? We are here to talk about your third novel, Skin Deep.
Yes.
Introduce us to the story of Skin Deep.
Well, Skin Deep starts off with the story of Cordelia, as she's styling herself. In her middle 50s, things have not gone well for her. She's living in the south of France. She is at a party taking cocaine with a guy, a stranger she's picked up at a bar. And she gets very drunk. She doesn't really belong at this party. It's a film premiere party. Everybody is younger and more beautiful than she is. But she gets very, very drunk and wakes up on the floor the next morning of the party and picks her way home through the back streets of Nice to her flat where the flies have begun to gather on the corpse she left there the night before. So that's the kind of opening kind of gamut. And then it goes back in time, whizzes back 50 years to her upbringing and her childhood on a very remote, very poverty-stricken island off the west coast of Ireland, a tiny island community where women are judged and valued for different reasons than the norm.
Yes, and okay, so we meet her as a young girl, and the first thing that strikes us and then hits us with a sledgehammer at the end of the book, is that children do never know the whole story.
No.
They never see the entire picture.
No.
And she grows up literally in the lap of her father's adoration.
Exactly. She thinks that her only value is her appearance. That is the only thing she puts any store in. And she mistakenly believes that because her father has told her that from a very young age, that she is the most beautiful girl in the world and that she is the queen of the island and that her perfection is in her beauty and that's why she's going to be queen of the island. But that's not why he's saying that. But we don't find that out until the very end of the book.
Very end. But I was fascinated by the depictions of island life. And it reminded me, you know, sort of the modern day government wanting to, it's expensive to keep people on these islands.
Yeah.
Impoverished though they are, they still need infrastructure, education, and medical care, which is more difficultly delivered to an island than the mainland.
Yeah, they're heavily subsidized by government. Heavily subsidized by government. But I got to tell you, actually, remarkably, the Irish Minister for Finance read Skin Deep, and within a couple of months, he had granted more money towards education on the islands to keep the island communities on the islands, because what was happening was the children were educated to primary school and then they left the islands to go to secondary school and pretty much never went back because they got integrated into mainland communities. So I like to think that I have influenced the Minister for Finance in Ireland to some degree. It could be complete bullshit, but I just like the thought that maybe he had second thoughts about that.
Well, I think one of the reasons he might have is that interspersed throughout the book are some of the island's legends that her father has told her, which is her inheritance in a way.
They're really grotesque gruesome stories that she's like stories that no child should ever be told, but they're really like all fairy tales, moralistic warnings, and particularly about how women should behave and
harsh retribution,
and women's place, and Ireland up until extremely recently has been a very patriarchal society, but that's changing, and I wanted to mark those this is being edited, isn't it? I wanted to mark those terrible injustices that have been done to women in the past in some way.
Your book, it is two things. At least.
Okay.
It is an incredible page turner. Obviously, we start off with a body.
Yeah.
So it is a suspense, you know, and people put it under the umbrella of domestic noir. But it is a dark, dark tale.
Sure.
But also through Cordelia or Delia's journey, we do see exactly what you're talking about, the changes that her life has spanned in Ireland.
Sure.
You know, from this small island to the mainland, still small town Ireland, town mores.
Exactly.
Moving to London, but moving to London as an Irish person.
Yes. Yeah, and trying to fit in and to assimilate. And she's quite a chameleon character, you know, she adapts to suit her surroundings. So when she finds herself in London high society, she assumes the accent, and she thinks that she's fitting in. Of course, she's caught out.
Yes.
But and then
so many times.
So many times, yeah. She's not really the smartest tool in the shed. She's a kind of an alley cat. She survives by instinct. She doesn't really think long term. She looks at the immediate solutions to her problems. So
her thinking, like her beauty, skin deep.
Exactly. Exactly. Yeah.
And it does get her into trouble.
Absolutely. Terrible, terrible trouble. She makes terribly bad decisions though as well. You know, it's not, you know, the nature nurture argument is always there in all of my books, and I leave that up to the reader. But I think in Delia's case, you could definitely argue both.
Mm.
You know, she's not a nice person, but would she have been a nice person if she'd had a normal childhood? Who knows?
Who knows? And do you have, she's not a nice person.
No.
But do you have sympathy for her?
Oh, yeah. I kind of like her because I was her when I was writing her. You know, because you have to inhabit the character especially because it's first person. So I'm writing as her. So, yeah, I have great sympathy. I don't condone half of what she does, but I understand it. I really do understand it. And, you know, the one thing that readers come back to me on a lot is a woman, they cannot forgive a woman who rejects her child. That is such a big taboo. And yet male characters in fiction reject their children all the time and can still be the heroes. Look at all those detective characters who are absent fathers, you know, who take their sons on the weekend reluctantly, but they're still the heroes of their stories.
Mm-hmm.
This is very much an anti-heroine. She is not a nice person. She is not a good person. But of all of the awful things that she does in the book, the one thing that the readers don't forgive is the fact that she rejects her child. Isn't that interesting?
Well, yes, because you think it's so ununderstandable. But something I just heard on the radio this morning was people getting therapy to figure out if they should be parents. And this was a woman who did not want to be a parent.
Yeah, yeah. Well, I think women...
Quite rightly.
Well, I think a lot of thought should be put into, you know, planning children. Obviously, you can't plan everything. Accidents happen, etc. But I know people who, and because I don't have children, because I am child free by choice. I have 18 nieces and nephews who I adore, and hopefully they adore me back. Well, they're better because I'm very generous to them, and I expect them to look after me in my old age. But I think that because I don't have kids, the women who struggle with motherhood are more likely to tell me about it than they would to their friends who are mothers. So I've heard from a couple of friends who say that, you know, they love their kids, but they wish they'd never had them. It's a fact.
Or didn't have them at the time, or too soon, or whatever. There's plenty of things. And that's why, I mean, I think it's very exciting that there is now choice in Ireland.
Oh, absolutely. God, you know, that campaign was long, long and hard fought. I did a little campaigning myself.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It's a difficult one, but giving women the choice. Well, and then there's less unwanted children.
Yes.
And, you know, Ireland, you know, doesn't have the greatest history where, you know, track record where it comes to unwanted children.
Exactly.
So the less, the better.
Well, at least Ireland is moving forward, as America may be moving backwards.
Yes.
Now, Brett Kavanaugh, the Supreme Court, he might reverse Roe versus Wade, and then, oh my God.
Well, yes.
You know, who ever thought that America would be a regressive society?
It comes as not only a shock, but a body blow to me personally.
Mm-hmm. I can understand that.
But let us talk about, because you are very well known in Ireland, but I wasn't aware of you.
Mm-hmm.
And you worked in theater and television prior to this.
Yeah.
But you also have two other books. Tell me how you made the transition to writing. And then I really want to talk about Unraveling Oliver and
Lying in Wait. Okay. I worked in theatre as a stage manager for 15 years or thereabouts, and I was always fascinated by the text. So I learned, if you think about it, I was always sitting there with the script as a stage manager. I am following the script with the actors, and I am listening to the actors and the director exploring every aspect of the dialogue and parsing it for themselves and, you know, questioning the meanings of certain scenes. So I guess I learned from the best. You know, I've worked in Shakespeare and Chekhov and Ibsen and our own playwrights, Brian Friel and Tom Murphy and Frank McGuinness, and I've just been extremely lucky to be immersed in that world. So, yeah, I think Arthur Miller as well, like all of these very human players, all men, now that I think about it. This is terrible. Marina Carr is also a wonderful Irish female playwright, and British playwrights Carol Churchill, but actually there's been a whole Waking the Feminist movement in Irish theatre in the last couple of years about the lack of female playwrights who get put on in Ireland. So we're now tackling that as a nation. But I did learn some extremely good lessons from how to construct a story through theatre. And then I moved from that into working in television, again in an administrative role, but on a soap opera. And the one thing about soap opera is you want your viewer to tune in the next day. So that's where I learned to write page-turning novels. Because at the end of every chapter, I just drop some little nugget in there that hopefully the reader will want to carry on and not put the book down. And luckily, it seems to have worked, because a lot of people tell me, oh, I read it in a day or 2 days or 3 days. Or
so I like that. So from a sort of stage managing, you sort of an overview of all the moving parts
exactly
together, and then the propulsive element of a soap opera. And is that also why I find your writing quite visual.
Yes, because there's nothing worse I have learned through my years in the theatre, and also judging. I then got to be a judge of the Irish Times Theatre Awards. So, and I still go to the theatre. I would go to the theatre probably twice a month, more often if I could, but I just really don't have the time. But yeah, I'm a regular theatre goer, and I think there is nothing worse than a stage play that should have been done on the radio. You know, you have to have stuff happening. You have to have incident. So I pack my books full of incident. I don't want anybody to get bored or kind of go, oh, I'll skip this bit. Hopefully there are no bits that the reader wants to skip.
I wouldn't recommend it. So tell me, what is, because I want people, I loved Skin Deep, mm-hmm. and I want people to be getting into that. And as an inducement, I will tell you what Marion Keyes said. I loved, loved, loved Skin Deep, the compassion of it, the beauty of the language, how glamour and horror intersect, how the tension twists tighter and tighter and is brilliantly done.
Oh, isn't Marion just lovely?
I couldn't put it better myself.
And she's my queen. I do love her. And I really appreciate that very generous quote from her.
Excellent. So what is the story of Unraveling Oliver?
Unraveling Oliver, Unraveling Oliver, that's my first novel. That opens with a man beating his wife into a coma on the first page.
Happy day.
Spoilers. No spoilers there. And then it tracks back through his life to see what brought him to this point. And there are some kind of, it shows him as a kind of a, he grows up more or less as an orphan. He has a father, but his father is completely and utterly negligent of him and abandons him to a boarding school at the age of 4 or 6 or something. And he's not allowed to come home for Christmas or holidays. And once he turns 18, he is left to his own devices. And he never knows why. You know, he tries to talk to his father, and the only thing his father has ever told him about his mother is that she was a whore. So he knows nothing about his mother. So it's that kind of childhood, what kind of man comes out of that boy, having had those like feelings of abandonment and emotional disconnection, never having had any familial connection. So by the end of the novel, this awful wife beater who is despicable and awful, you will understand why. That's you won't forgive or condone, but you will understand why. And along the way, you'll spend a good few chapters in the south of France in a vineyard with a group of students.
Sensing a theme.
You will, yeah.
Unlikable people in the south of France. Yes. Fantastic.
Yeah. Well, I'm lying in wait. I can go to Rome for a day. I make all my holidays tax deductible by setting my books in the places I want to go.
It's all research.
Yeah, yes. It's all research.
It's all research.
So, but there's multiple narrators in that. So it's not just Oliver telling you his story. There are also all of the people who think that they know him. His gay school friend, his gay college friend, his wife's learning disabled brother, his former employer in the vineyard, his old school friend from his early boarding school days, his wife's old neighbor, you know, all of these people get to give their opinion on what they think of Oliver as well, and it turns out he's fooled them all. But the twist, or I hate the word twist, the surprise, I guess, for me as I was writing it and for the reader, is that Oliver doesn't know certain aspects of his own background until the end, and they come roaring up to meet him at the end.
Excellent. And I would say there's similar twists in Skin Deep.
Yes. Yep.
Learning as they go along.
Learning as they go along.
As we all do. Hopefully not as dramatically and with as high body counts.
No.
Okay, so also tell me about Lying in Wait.
Lying in Wait The first line of Lying in Wait is, "My husband did not mean to kill Annie Doyle, but the lying tramp deserved it." And it's the story of a very damaged middle-aged woman and her unhealthily obsessive relationship with her teenage son, who she is determined will never grow up. She wants to keep him as a child. And she and her husband commit this terrible murder, and this isn't a spoiler, this is all in the first chapter, and bury the corpse of this young girl in their back garden. And her husband is an eminent judge, so nobody is going to question them too hard. You know, they come from good background and good stock, so they are the last people who would be suspected of being involved in this disappearance, because to all intents and purposes, nobody knows where Annie Doyle has gone. She has disappeared. But the three main characters are this awful woman, her teenage son Lawrence, who pieces together bits of what he thinks are the truth of what happened to Annie Doyle, and Annie Doyle's sister, who's from a very working class background, who never gives up on the search for her sister. Mm-hmm. And it's when Lawrence and Karen, Annie's sister, and Lydia, the matriarchal figure, collide. A lot of fireworks.
It seems to me that you put supreme downward pressure on your characters in order to explore a host of other things.
Well, I think it's the best way I know how to start a book is to have a character in an extreme situation and see how they react to it in the moment. Because in each of the books, it starts with somebody reacting to a terrible cataclysmic incident. And in their reaction, thereby ye shall know them, to misquote somebody. But, you know, that's their reactions and how they deal with those incidents tells you everything you need to know about them, and hopefully makes them compelling enough for the reader to stay with them.
It's a bit mean.
Yeah. But the pressure is on me as much as it is on the reader.
You don't put us through anything you haven't gone through yourself.
Exactly.
Come out the other side.
Yeah.
Excellent. Well, I loved Skin Deep. I'm really looking forward to reading the other two.
Great.
And I'm trying to figure out what might be next. I'm going to make a supposition.
Okay.
I understand you have a bursary, you've won a bursary, and you're going to spend a month in Paris.
That's right.
Something the next place, the next place that one of your characters might end up just might be in Paris.
Yes. Yes, there will be, it's not a huge part of the book. My next novel, which won't be out until April 2020, so I don't know why I'm even talking about it now. And I'm only saying I'm on a first draft, so this may all get thrown out. But it's the story of three brothers.
Excellent.
And in the opening chapter, one of the brothers has murdered one of the other brothers. But we don't know which has killed which brother, and we don't know why. So that's the kind of setup. But one of the brothers will spend time in Paris to justify my bursary.
Exactly. Yeah. Liz Nugent, thank you so much for coming on to Radio Gorgeous.
Thank you. I really enjoyed the chat.
For more fascinating women, go to www.radiogorgeous.com.